Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. We make decisions about our health every day, whether we name it a decision or not. Just this morning, it's 11 a.m. as I'm writing this intro, I've made many health decisions. At 2 a.m., I decided to get out of bed, eat something, and take ibuprofen for hip and leg pain. I chose waffles over granola for breakfast. I drank coffee rather than water to quench my thirst. We decided to drive to a boardwalk for a hike, and I decided to stop sooner than I'd have liked because I'm feeling weaker and my balance is more unstable. I decided to stop taking high-dose biotin because my friend Sherry Binns, next week's podcast guest, sent me some new research saying that biotin has little or no effect on multiple sclerosis. Phew, six healthcare decisions I can remember in 12 hours. According to healthit.gov, Clinical Decision Support, or CDS, provides clinicians, staff, patients, or other individuals with knowledge and person-specific information intelligently filtered or presented at appropriate times to enhance health and healthcare. CDS encompasses a variety of tools. I'm not done yet. CDS encompasses a variety of tools to enhance decision-making in the clinical workflow. These tools include computerized alerts and reminders to care providers and patients, clinical guidelines, condition-specific order sets, focused patient data reports and summaries, documentation templates, diagnostic support, and contextually relevant reference information, among other tools. Oh my God. Can you believe that definition? How about computable, evidence-informed guidance used when making clinical decisions? That's still kind of remote, isn't it? How about information to make health choices for people who need it, when they need it, in a manner they can use in a context that reflects their life experience? Okay, enough with the definitions. I have and have had several ARC-funded, that's AHRQ, or Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. I've had consulting gigs about CDS, Clinical Decision Support, with the MITRE Corporation. Today's guests include Edwin Lomatin from ARC, and Lacey Fabian from MITRE's CDS Connect. The CDS Connect repository supports ARC's mission to disseminate and implement patient-centered outcome research findings into clinical practice through CDS. Entries in this repository include CDS artifacts, which are actionable medical knowledge, like clinical practice guidelines, peer-reviewed articles, local best practices, and clinical quality measures translated into computable and interoperable decision support. Oh my goodness, again, phew. Perhaps maybe a library of medical recommendations made useful for programming into electronic records, apps, and software, so patients, caregivers, and clinicians can use them as they make health choices together? I haven't vetted that with anyone. I've worked with Ed for many years and Lacey this past year. Both commit to patient-caregiver engagement in CDS. support my inclusion in several projects, and seek my expertise and networks in the patient caregiver community. Lacey and Ed, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed working with both of you, and I look forward to this conversation. Lacey, how do you introduce yourself to people?
Sure. Thanks, Danny. So I'm a research psychologist with MITRE, who works at the national level on ways to improve the quality of healthcare.
Okay. Well, that is succinct. Great. And Ed, how do you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Ed Lomaten. I'm Chief of Clinical Informatics at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, or AHRQ, or ARC for short. My position is in a division called the Division of Digital Healthcare Research, which is in a large center called the Center for Evidence and Practice Improvement. I add that I'm a pediatrician with specialized training in clinical informatics, and I lead my agency's work on clinical decision support. Way too long for most social situations.
So Ed, oh my goodness, we've been working together 3 or 4 years anyway. You're really quite the advocate for patient and caregiver engagement. I feel like you're somebody who has really steps up to figure out different ways to include people in clinical decision support. But I don't get the feeling like you started out that way. And how did that evolve for you?
Great question, Danny. I suppose there are a couple of things I would point to. I credit you a lot, actually, for opening my eyes and having that desire to learn more about how to do that. The very first time I met you was at a steering committee for the Patient-Centered Clinical Decision Support Learning Network. I learned a lot from you, including patient caregiver input in a meaningful way early on in projects. So I actually point to that specific day a lot as sort of a beginning of a journey. Prior to that, I think a lot of where I come from is this belief in the ARC mission. It's a really strong mission. And sort of, you know, to go back to how I introduced myself, if I do spend any extra time telling people what I do, it's usually about ARC as an agency, because folks tend to not know about it as much. And I think telling folks what the ARC mission is around equitability and affordability and making healthcare safer and higher quality, I think decision support and patient centeredness fit mm-hmm. nicely into it.
Well, I'm honored. I'm honored to have had an effect. That's great. Thank you for that. Lacey, so you said you were a psychologist in informatics?
No, I started out in the clinical program for clinical psychology.
Okay.
I did all of my clinical training and realized that it was better for me to stay on the research side because for me, the voice of the patient, if you will, and the caregivers were hard to leave at the office. I struggled with separating all of those emotions.
Yes. How has that been for you in terms of bringing the voice of the patient into your work?
I was doing one of my last clinical rotations actually at Johns Hopkins and in the traumatic brain injury unit. Oh. And my preceptor at the time provided some words of wisdom. She was a very eager and very inspiring caregiver provider. And she had said that if you have a patient and they're not improving anymore, then you need to advise that patient to go help them find somebody new, because there's always a provider out there who can find something new for that patient or innovate in some way that's mm-hmm. going to help them continue to improve their quality of life. And you need to always have that zest that there should always be improving and there should always be that expectation for more in these kinds of situations.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that really resonates now in the clinical decision support space and working at the level that I do now, which I consider it when I do talk to other people, I think of it as that national level. So it can seem fairly distal, but what I can do is make sure that in a space where clinical decision support is seen as such a highly technical field, that we don't forget We are ultimately trying to get at those patient and caregiver interactions with providers. Mm-hmm. And no matter that we're operating kind of up here and we're doing something that has all these acronyms and all of this, you know, complex language and coding and all this good stuff, which is very important and very relevant. But at the end of the day, we're trying to help people make decisions and help people in many cases who are, as you said, Danny, fraught with lots of emotions and challenges and other things. So if we can make it just a little bit simpler for that provider to help their patients informing those decisions and feel good about those decisions, then that's what I try to keep in mind at this work and in this project in particular.
Interesting. Ed, the last time I saw you in person, we had a little bit of a discussion. And one of the things that I came away from that thinking was that this challenge of including lay people in some of this sophisticated, acronym-filled, kind of remote world is twofold. Both the ability of people that aren't in that expert bubble to feel comfortable enough to contribute. And then the other side of it is the ability of people who are full of that expertise in the bubble to be able to listen to and use somewhat raw, not necessarily seemingly directly pertinent. There's so many challenges to scaling this that it's one thing that you and I kind of found each other and you've helped me be introduced and accepted into this world. And as you're saying, I introduced you, but I don't think we're every day, that this relationship you and I have is that every day relationship. But so, like, what do you think about that challenge of trying to scale this?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer about the scaling question. In fact, I would love to hear your ideas, Danny, because I think you hit the nail right on the head. One of the things I've learned, and maybe it's the clinician in me, but one of the things that I've learned over the last few years of thinking about this more is, boy, as you said, listening is probably more half the battle, right? And just being flexible. So whether you're a patient or a CDS designer, I think going in with that frame of mind, I said, look, I'm going to listen and try to keep my processes or whatever I'm trying to do flexible enough to hear what people have to say and to be able to absorb that in a meaningful way. Just give yourself that ability, you know, freedom, honestly, to listen. From the perspective of folks who aren't necessarily in the bubble, let's say from a patient activist side, for me, I don't think, I mean, yes, it would be nice if folks sort of knew all the acronyms already or sort of knew what we were talking about in terms of, you know, quote unquote, clinical decision support. But on the other hand, I often encourage folks just to tell us what's on your mind. You don't have to necessarily know the space to contribute something meaningful. And it's often when you don't think something's meaningful that it actually is. And so that's the part of folks in the room to be just quiet and listen and be able to absorb that. From the perspective of CDS designers, I think the challenge there, as we've encountered, is we've all got deadlines, project deadlines and contract deadlines and grant deadlines and so forth. So I think being able to listen and synthesize and incorporate something actionable and to be able to show your patient activists or group of people that you listen to them, I think is a challenge because you want to actually do something meaningful with that input. And it's not always clear what those things are.
Lacey, one of the things that's interesting to me, having worked with MITRE, I led some EHR implementation initiatives, and I realized the importance of having a clean and sound database or databases before you start trying to implement something. But one of the things that I've learned working with MITRE on several projects over the last few years is how much work it is to do some of the simplest, like what seems to me, I just want to wave my magic wand And why can't we do this? And I hear people say now, like in the activist world, they should be able to whatever. And from working with MITRE, what I've been able to say is, do you know how hard that is to actually do? What's been your experience with your own desire to have the technology accomplish something and how much work it is to actually move it like 6 inches, if not 1 inch?
Yes, I would like to say, wait, what are you talking about? But I know what you're talking about. I'll build on to Ed's comments about, you know, the listening and coming in and potentially not being able to act on what we hear and those types of things. I'll probably pull on this thread throughout. It's kind of the level that we're operating at, right? So if we work at a national level, then we have lots of extra things that we have to incrementally get through that in a perfect world, we'd be able to say, you know, easy, it's done, and then be able to move on. And that's the kind of thing, that sort of decision is something we might be able to make at an individual level and make that happen. Mm-hmm. Maybe we might even be able to make it within our own, you know, healthcare organization and just kind of make it happen. But once we keep kind of moving up levels, we do add that kind of red tape to it because of where the decision is operating, and it starts to bring with it so many other pieces and contexts. And a lot of times those pieces are really important because they're the pieces that bring in that diverse viewpoint. So as opposed mm-hmm. to it being one person who's trying to push something that seems like it should be straightforward mm-hmm. and seems like it is going to hit all the marks. Well, a lot of times we need those other points to come in and say, wait, what about this? And mm-hmm. I think that to still keep it constructive for advocates and activists who are participating in that patient voice is that coming at the discussion with a lot of honesty, you know, from the patients and caregivers, but making sure that it's constructive honesty mm-hmm. too, to recognize that it's coming into a context where there are going to be these additional challenges. There are going to be things you wish weren't there that are. But on the flip side, if as a project team or somebody working in that space and you hear that honest and constructive feedback from your, you know, caregivers and advocates who are, you know, engaged in the project with you, make sure you have space to hear that constructive feedback and make sure you mm-hmm. have enough humbleness and setting aside any kind of egos or anything like that so you can hear mm-hmm. Ed's point about listening. Mm-hmm. So you can hear what they're actually saying and acknowledge its importance and that it may not happen tomorrow. It may not happen this year, mm-hmm. but we can take that information in and one day, rest assured, mm-hmm. it will be the right day and we'll get back to it and be able to move it to the next level. So yeah. Honest, constructive feedback.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge to record your doctor visit. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com. ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went. So, Ed, I'm on that strategic planning group for ARC, and it's met several times. And one of the things that I found myself saying last week when we, you know, had a half-day session was that that there's such a mismatch to me of the questions people have. So now I'm thinking in the COVID world, because that's what we're all like up to our eyeballs in. When we look at the evidence that's out there. There's a mismatch between the questions that people have as they're trying to manage the uncertainty of life in COVID, and there's very little evidence out there to help answer the questions. And it makes me think that I find in this space is that we start with the evidence and then we think about computerizing it rather than these are the questions people have. How can the technology help us get to faster, more equitable access to evidence-informed guidance so that people can make decisions about testing, about school, about whatever. So how, you know, what do you think of that? Like, you know.
Yeah, big questions. You know, it's interesting because I think you're right. You know, with COVID just sort of brings this all to the fore. It's just right in front of us, this sort of this mismatch between the amount of evidence and the evidence that we need. And on the other hand, you know, it's a question that's existed for a long time. I don't think there ever is a time where all the evidence we need is all there at all the time or when we need it. So in some ways, it's an age-old question, but it just seems more important now or more pressing. From my perspective, I think you also hit on it too. It's really about how to get those learning cycles faster. Right. So,
That's a good way to put it. Yes.
How do you generate evidence and put it into a form that folks can use and then get it back to the people who are making decisions around it, whether you're a patient or whether you're a clinical decision support designer or whether you're a healthcare system leader? I think that's where I think a lot of what we talk about around systems and infrastructure can help, because you're trying to make those learning cycles faster. Call it learning healthcare system, learning healthcare environments, or what have you. I also think that that's also precisely the space where we need patient and caregiver input, right? Because in that space of lack of certainty, that's where you need people to come together and to recognize where those gaps are. And it's really the absence of adequate evidence that shared decision making really needs to happen. But overall, I think it's how do we get the learning cycles faster?
Yeah. So Lacey, I've been, you know, 2 or 3 years working with CDS Connect. And one of the reasons I do it is that I think this business of a repository, of ready access for people to the evidence that's out there is really important. But when I talk to people about it, oh man, it is so hard to get a hook. I mean, when I talk to people, I mean not clinicians, not informaticists, but people who are very involved with research. In fact, I have an interview scheduled next week with somebody who's really involved in the MS community. She is on the board of an MS research organization. I wanted to interview her, and I had to like really talk her into doing it, because she felt like when I sent her, you know, some previous work I've done about CDS Connect, I sent her to the website, and she was like, why, you know, like what? So I'm not like saying that as criticism, but actually I am, in the sense of that we need to do the step of why this is important. And that link, what we were just talking about, that it answers questions people have. And so I can't remember, and Ed, you might remember better than me, but there was the one, maybe it was last year, it was about the preventative guidelines, and what you'd think, like that would be stuff that people could zero right in on. It's, you know, accessing the preventative guidelines. So you're eyeball deep in this stuff. Well, even with clinicians, like how does CDS Connect, this having a repository of guidelines, how does that serve clinicians, like the day-to-day clinicians, not the EHR developers, not the app developers, but people who are like clinicians who are working to make decisions with people? How does CDS serve them, CDS Connect?
Yes, I'll carry on with the big questions. And we said earlier on about the honest feedback, and I'll give you an honest answer that I'm not sure if we're there yet. I don't know if we're there yet, in the sense that this is all CDS, even in general, let alone the CDS Connect project, is quite new. It's a new field in many ways. And before working with the clinical decision support space, I worked with quality measures, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what I consider a slightly older space, mm-hmm. but is, you know, similarly fraught with challenges of so what and what's the impact and mm-hmm. how is it impacting this individual person. And I think that what's really exciting about clinical decision support is that we're looking to pull in the technology, and we're trying to actively engage what we've been able to build just as a society with mm-hmm. our access and the way we can share data. And we're trying, kind of desperately, I think, to bring that into play because we can see the vision. We can see where mm-hmm. getting things in a more automated fashion, getting things to getting technologies to talk to each other is all going to help that day-to-day mm-hmm. clinician. And in order to do that, we have to start from the beginning. We have to build it and get those things to start talking. We have to start testing it out, which we've been doing. We have to start working with people and adding in the layers, mm-hmm. like Ed had talked about, with that, you know, learning cycle and a learning system. And once mm-hmm. we kind of fine tune as we're going around, I think that that's how we'll be able to get to that next phase of, mm-hmm. yes, this is impacting the day-to-day. And yes, this decision support that's operating in the background, I see it and I know it's there and I can mm-hmm. feel its value even as a clinician and a patient.
The thread here that I'm hearing that's really important to me is that we're doing something, we're using it, and we're learning from it. Data, like a database, you know, what's a database? A database is nothing until it's used. And then once it's used, then you find the errors in it, the weaknesses of it. It gets better from use. I certainly appreciate having worked with MITRE and RTI and ARC is that learning. That thoughtfulness of, okay, yes, we did this. We tried this. It went pretty well. It didn't do this. It didn't do that. Here's the next. That's one of the things I appreciate about ARC is that leadership of let's what's the next iteration? How do we build on what we've learned in this not necessarily ideal state? What should I be asking you guys that I'm not about this computable decision support world?
I was trying to think about if I were on the other side listening to this, what mm-hmm. questions would I have and where would I be trying to figure out where my voice is? And mm-hmm. that took me back to a version of the so what question and that reminder that we can all be learning. So even if we're not working on national projects, even if we're, you know, not regularly going to see clinicians, you know, every week or every month, or we're not a clinician, every day we're making decisions about our health. We're deciding if we're going to drink the water. We're deciding if we're going to sleep, those kinds of things. That to me was the so what for connecting something like clinical decision support that's working behind the scenes. It's highly technical, is just to think of it that way. You know, mm-hmm. it's helping make decisions and understand kind of how we got to that decision mm-hmm. and recognizing that those decisions are happening all the time and asking people to consider what's important to them when they do make that decision. And are they hopeful that those options that are being presented are based on evidence or trustworthy or all those kinds of things?
Thank you. What do you think, Ed?
Yeah, Danny, there are lots of questions. It's just fun to explore and to brainstorm with you about. And I think one you asked earlier, and it had to do with scale, right? So if we're thinking really about co-designing decision support, implementing it with patients and caregivers and other folks, what does that look like? What do we need to get there? And so I think that's one. Another question that feeds into that is, I would love to sort of hear how folks talk about the role for research in this dissemination and implementation aspect. So not just research, like clinical research or even clinical guidance sort of type of research. What's the best way to engage patients and caregivers in co-design? How do we know it's making a difference? What tools the designers and patient activists need to make the design faster and more efficient? And those are, from my perspective, wonderful research questions. Mm-hmm. That we need, to your point, evidence for. So this is not just evidence about what to do clinically, but evidence how to do what we do, you and I and Lacey mm-hmm. together. Because I think once you can build that evidence base and learn the best practices, we'll know how and what to scale. And so this goes, again, back to the learning cycles. Some ARC grantees are already doing some of this, and I know you're probably familiar with them. So just off the top of my head, some folks like Ken Kalmoto and David Doerr and Dan Malone, their whole projects are to learn how to incorporate this type of expertise and tell us, better ways to do it. I think talking about how to incorporate scientific investigative approaches mm-hmm. into finding answers about patient engagement, I think is going to help all of us.
One of the things that comes up in these kinds of conversations is, oh man, that is so hard to do. Just thinking about something that's such a leap. Let me give you an example. Sometimes I feel like a broken record. And one of my skips in my broken record is that it doesn't make sense to me that we have these guidelines, we have evidence, and what we put our effort into is trying to get people to make decisions following the evidence. Where to me, I would rather see, well, people make decisions for all sorts of different reasons, whether they're clinicians or lay people. Why doesn't our system record the decision that was made and then look at, well, what were the outcomes? Because then we would be doing research in real time. We made the decision not to follow. I'm not taking the lower my cholesterol medications. Okay, so then what happened to me? I'm this, old white man of privilege, and as opposed to a Native American living in New Mexico, we would build this body of evidence. And people say, well, do you realize how hard that is to do? And then I think, well, why don't we just have a hackathon and say, here's this crazy problem. Now, this is an important problem. It's a crazy problem. We really have no idea how to solve this problem. But let's just have the grant be $100,000 for the winner and paying for the convening of people, and then put the problem out there and let people say, well, to solve this problem, you need A, B, C, and D. And then you've got like the beginning of a roadmap to solve a difficult problem. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think you've got a great idea. And in fact, people have asked this question. I don't know if there's been a hackathon or a challenge or already that's been put out there. We make decisions, whether it's clinicians or patients or caregivers, every day. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to learn from what decisions we've made and what the difference made. So I think it's a combination of tech, I suppose, and sort of giving people the tools and have capturing things and also recording why you made decisions. I'm not sure that I personally know all the decisions, why I make some things and why I don't, why I choose one path versus the other. Right. and figuring out how to capture that uncertainty and or capture that sort of reasoning, I think is part of the problem. But I think it's a great idea. And I know folks are thinking about it and have tried to tackle in certain use cases, certain clinical domains, but it's, it's a big question.
Lacey, what are your thoughts?
For me, it automatically, I start to think about the steps then. And so why haven't we done that? And what is holding back something like that? And I was questioning whether that's the degree we want to, you know, go into or explore, even tap the surface. But then of course, like recording answers, the first thing that comes to mind is what's going on in other spheres of MITRE and HHS about privacy. And who owns the data and what's going to happen with it when it's out there and how's it going to be used? And, you know, that's my mind starts to immediately go into those kinds of practicals as that's the rub. Those are the kinds of things that are going to start to come up, and
they are,
we're working on it.
But. Yeah. Before we wrap up, I have to include this. Ed, you had such a important influence for me in terms of making a really important decision in my life, which was whether or not to go with my wife on the Camino hike. I'm a two-cane and wheelchair guy, and my wife is a serious hiker. And she and her friends had decided they're going to go to Spain and hike the Camino. And it just so happened that I saw Ed within days of hearing her plan. And I'm thinking, oh my God, she's going to leave me behind. And I don't know why I was saying that to Ed. And he just was telling me about his experience with his dad. And he said, oh, you absolutely can do it. And so I thought, okay, well, I can absolutely do it. And we went and just had a blast. And it was such a lift to be able to accomplish that together. Anyway, I want to thank you for that, Ed. That was an important decision. It didn't involve any technology.
Thanks, Danny. I enjoy talking with you about that. And for folks listening, this is, you know, obviously entirely separate from my ARC role. But Danny and I share a common experience of having done this Camino, this walk in Spain at two different times. That walk is meant to be a time of reflection. I can tell you, having done that walk, reflecting on work and what's important and in terms of helping patients, again, going back to the ARC mission and making healthcare better, I think that definitely came up on my walk. Seeing folks of all different walks of life, literally, do that, the Camino, I think also it's important to get that perspective out there, out in the world. And I think that, for me, it's been a good refresher, sort of a channel, channel that into our everyday work. But yeah, it's a great, great walk. And I'm glad you and I have that connection, Danny.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate you guys taking the time, and I enjoy working together with you guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danny. It's an honor and a pleasure. And thanks, Lacey.
All right, guys. Talk to you later. I'm struck by several themes in this conversation with Lacey and Ed. Even when you've drunk the Kool-Aid about engaging patients and caregivers early and often, scaling that process, growing it across the industry, challenges all of us. Perhaps we can hone our listening skills and build learning health systems that can decrease the cycle time for change as we figure out scaling. Another theme is patience with the slowness of national processes. I challenge the assumption that change must be slow and steady. Adoption of telehealth was slow and steady for years until COVID, and then in a flash, adoption. Government could convene stakeholders with the goal of rapid movement toward testing solutions to complex problems. Provide prizes, keep solutions created in those forums open source for anyone to use. People could make money on the implementation of those open source solutions. Finally, so what is a great question that should be asked and answered often. One of the best quotes I've read about decision making is from my muse, Mark Twain. Good decisions come from experience. experience comes from making bad decisions. The low tolerance for making mistakes and changing our minds, especially in science and politics, makes me crazy. How can we learn if we don't accept learning? Oh my goodness, another tough one. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.